versus Dirge. Mr. Gallinari?
Good morning. May it please the court. Defendants moved to compel arbitration or stay proceedings pending arbitration. In this case, the district court denied that petition. We pursued our immediate right of appeal and seek reversal of the district court decision and an order referring the claims to arbitration or a stay of the case pending that arbitration. This is a case where Mr. Stone, on behalf of two trusts, opened securities accounts with David Durge, who
have
worked
have
for...
Have you read our recent case in Fufas versus Drew by any chance?
I have not, Your Honor.
Fufas. Well, that was very similar.
I've read Smith versus Steinkamp, but not
right,
Fufas
no.
versus
well,
Drew.
Well, Fufas is more recent, but I what's troublesome about your appeal is it's hard to understand the logic of your position, because this is a dispute that has nothing to do with Bear Stearns.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the arbitration clause seems to, be to protect Bear Stearns against, or agents of Bear Stearns against, having to go to court if they're involved in dispute, but this seems to be unrelated.
Well, there's plenty of case law as precedent that says that the introducing broker is entitled to rely upon the arbitration clause in the clearing broker's form agreements, even if the clearing broker is not named as a defendant.
And I wish one of you had read Nissan North America versus Jim Malady Automobile, which is a 2002 case, because it would have been very helpful. But not to you, unfortunately.
Well, Your Honor, this is an agreement that does not even limit itself to the opening and maintenance of accounts. This is an agreement that governs not only opening and maintaining accounts, but otherwise transacting business with you. It's an agreement that confers third-party beneficiary status upon Bayless,
well,
Lewis and Coleman as the introducing
brokers. Stone in the nose, would that also be arbitrable?
I believe that all matters is all matters. In the circuit court
the
of
answer is yes.
Yes, Your Honor. In the circuit court of Cook County, any claim would have to be sent to arbitration before it were tried if it fell below a certain amount in controversy.
No,
there's
that's
no
quite different.
Well,
quite different.
I understand that. I understand that, Your Honor. But even if the court were concerned for public policy reasons about drawing a distinction between involuntary
policy, it's nothing to do with public policy. Just what is reasonable?
Well, then the reasonable expectations of the parties. Then,
let me finish. What is reasonable to assume about the understandings and expectations of the parties when they sign arbitration clause? It would be very odd if Mr. Durge punched Stone in the nose for Durge then to insist that Stone couldn't bring a suit for battery. It would have to be arbitrated. That would be very odd to think that that's what he had agreed to.
Well, then, if the court's concerned with the reasonable expectations of the parties were to draw a distinction between that type of involuntary relationship and matters that one party voluntarily entrusts to another party's care, then I suggest that's where the distinction ought to be drawn.
The difference is between activity, relation between Stone and Durge that involve Bear Stearns, and completely separate activities. That's what the punch in the nose is. It doesn't have anything to do with Bear Stearns' role as a clearing broker, and neither does this case.
Well, there's no way of knowing at the outset whether somebody is going to try to implead Bear Stearns, whether a plaintiff is going to be enterprising and try to name Bear Stearns as an additional defendant and say even though Bear Stearns wasn't involved, it should have exercised additional supervisory responsibility over its introducing broker.
Well, then you can get arbitration, right, if they do that.
Well, then you allow the plaintiff to avoid the effect of the arbitration clause by determining which among several defendants he's going to sue. He simply says, I'm not going to sue Bear Stearns.
Bear Stearns to be held. What you gave was a very different case. You gave a case in which Bear Stearns actually is involved, however indirectly. And then you say, well, Stone shouldn't be permitted to avoid arbitration just by not naming Bear Stearns. That's fine. But here, the transactions between Dirge and Stone don't have anything to do with Bear Stearns. If they did, then you'd have a good case.
Do you mean to say that since Dirge once acted as a broker, for which Bear Stearns acted as the clearing agent, that he maintains this identity for the rest of his career? I mean, suppose he acts as a broker selling private investments and finds out later that the client happened to sign an arbitration agreement with Bear Stearns. Well, when making a completely unrelated transaction, is that client subject to the arbitration agreement?
I'm not sure if I understand.
Is he in a dispute with Dorsch?
I'm not sure if I understand Your Honor's question. Here, we know that the clearing relationship was coextensive with the sale and purchase of the private investments in the account.
That's
Are you saying that if the clearing relationship ended and the relationship between Dirge and Stone then continued, would Dirge be entitled to refer back to this arbitration agreement?
Maybe I can try. It's a question that concerned me, too. Both Stone has an account with Bear Stearns and has signed the arbitration agreement with Bear Stearns. And Bear Stones has a completely separate account with Dirge. And in dealing with Dirge, has never in any way had Dirge work through Bear Stearns. And now there's a dispute between Stone and Dirge. Is that covered by the arbitration agreement? On the ground that Stone has signed the contract with Bear Stearns, and Dirge, in completely, you know, for Smith and Jones, acts as an introducing broker for Bear Stearns. And therefore, Dirge says, Stone has to arbitrate their disputes with me.
I don't know, but it's certainly distinguishable from this case.
Why don't you know?
Your
argument that this contract should be read for all it's worth, however stupid that may be in the real world, suggests that has to be arbitrated. What is the principle that is leading you to say you don't know the answer to that question when you did know the answer to Judge Posner's question about assault or car crashes or something like that?
The arbitration clause refers to your broker. And in this case, the reasonable expectation of Mr. Stone is that Mr. Dirge and Bayless, Lewis, and Coleman are his brokers.
But for the transactions at issue in this case, Dirk simply was not a broker for which Bear Stearns acted as a clearing agent.
That's true, Your Honor, but there nevertheless was the brokerage-client relationship between Mr. Dirge and Mr. Stone. That's one of the bases on which Mr. Stone is claiming that a duty is owed by BLC to the plaintiff on the basis of the brokerage-client relationship that was created by virtue of this agreement.
But we have to look at the transaction at issue here. Here, in this case.
Well, I believe that the standard is that if the agreement is susceptible of any interpretation that covers the asserted dispute, then we must refer to arbitration.
Why?
Because that's what the Seventh Circuit has said in C.K. Witko and what the Supreme Court has said in AT&T. That's the relevant legal standard.
No, I thought what the Supreme Court said is you have to figure out what the contract means. You don't figure out whether somebody can argue without breaking out into laughter in favor of arbitration. That's the standard you just articulated. You figure out what the contract actually means.
Well, I believe that if there are two competing interpretations and one is not laughable and one interpretation leads to the conclusion of arbitration, then arbitration should be ordered. I believe that that's what the standard means.
And why do you believe that?
Because that's the way I interpret the language, unless it may be said with positive assurance that the agreement is not susceptible of an interpretation that covers the asserted dispute. That's the standard that this court previously and the Supreme Court have previously
Well, announced. I don't think so. Arbitration is just a matter of contract, and people can agree to arbitrate or not agree, and whether they agreed or not is decided like any other contract question.
No different one.
I respectfully disagree based upon the precedent, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gallinari. Mr. Kins?
Good morning, Your Honors. The issue on appeal is very straightforward. There's no dispute of fact, and the district court correctly held that the arbitration provision in this matter is not susceptible of an interpretation that covers the instant dispute. The five alleged transactions in the complaint.
Does New York law play any role in this determination?
I don't believe it does with respect to determining arbitrability.
Why? Is that because there are no applicable principles of New York law?
No. I think with respect to deciding the arbitrability of a provision, federal law applies.
Why?
Because that's what the cases have held.
Why? We know, for example, that a demand for arbitration is not a claim arising under federal law. If it were, there would always be jurisdiction of all arbitration cases in federal court under 1331.
Mm-hmm.
And we keep saying that that's not true, that arbitration contracts are just contracts. They're resolved under state law, unless there's diversity, diversity jurisdiction might be available. But the proposition that federal law is supplying the claim is a proposition that every arbitration dispute can be litigated in federal court under 1331.
Well, if I may, Your Honor, having said that federal law applies, let me further say that the federal cases that have said that have said, however, we will look to state contract law to determine the issue of arbitrability. That is to say, well-settled state contract law. So by that, New York law may be applicable, Illinois law may be applicable, but it is the well-settled state contract law that is the basis for the federal courts to decide arbitrability. One thing too, Your Honor.
And is there anything in New York law that would be unusual for this purpose?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. In fact, Judge St. Eve cited...
One might say that there is a principle of federal law that state law cannot be hostile to arbitration. But if we're just figuring out what the ordinary state rules of contract interpretation are, one would think the Federal Arbitration Act itself has already referred us to them.
That's correct. That's correct.
So that leaves my question, is there any unusual or odd principle of contract interpretation law in New York that we need to pay attention to?
No, and in fact, the district court did cite two New York cases in her opinion, which in effect set out the well-established rule that it's the intention of the parties to the contract that governs what they wanted to arbitrate.
I will bet you anything that that's not New York's rule. Because, of course, the very next thing they will say is, and intention is determined objectively, that New York does not conduct a hunt through people's heads looking for the state of their mind. It looks at their words and deeds.
That's correct.
Right? It has an objective theory of interpretation, which
and
makes me wonder why we don't use Occam's razor and stop talking about intent.
We have the contract, Your Honor, that's at issue here, and it's the intent is clear from that contract, as the district court found, that there was no intention to arbitrate the dispute that doesn't involve Bear Stearns and the dispute that's alleged here.
Well, let me just throw this at you, Mr. Kins. Couldn't one argue that Bear Stearns wants to protect brokers who feed business to it, and therefore, through its agreements, it seeks to protect those brokers even in transactions in which Bear Stearns is not involved?
We have no indication that that certainly was the intention of Bear Stearns, and you can't get that intention from the contract language, because the contract is clearly limited to Bear Stearns acting as a clearing agent, and the third-party beneficiary provision applies to clearance accounts. And let me just state that the arbitration provision here is paragraph 24. And paragraph 24 says that Stone and the Bear Stearns entity or any broker for which Bear Stearns acts as clearing agent shall be determined by arbitration. Now, paragraph 9, which is what defendants have to rely upon, is entitled clearance accounts. And all that does is, and it's not the arbitration provision, it just only makes the defendants third-party beneficiaries of all the terms and conditions of that agreement and all matters where Bear Stearns acts as the clearing agent on clearance accounts. So therefore, the all matters that the defendants rely upon to claim that there's an agreement to arbitrate all matters does not appear in the arbitration provision, is in paragraph 9, and clearly means that all the terms and conditions of that Bear Stearns agreement applies to transactions where Bear Stearns is a clearing agent. Now, if it were not so, then by defendants' interpretation, all the terms and conditions of this Bear Stearns agreement apply to the five transactions in question, even if those transactions have their own separate subscription agreements. So you have to look at the Bear Stearns agreement, which talks about security deposits, about short sales, long sales. And by defendant's theory, which he expressly affirmed, is that this applies to all disputes before between the defendants and Stone. So if there are other transactions, business dealings between the two, by defendant's theory, and if there's a dispute in arbitration, by defendant's theory, the arbitration would have to be before the New York Stock Exchange, NASD, or the American Stock Exchange under paragraph 45, even if that controversy involved punching you in the nose. So it's clearly totally illogical and leads to absurd results. And the example that Judge Easterbrook posited with respect to one broker dealing only in securities and the other broker dealing with private placements but had a customer agreement with other customers with respect to trading through Bear Stearns, yes, by their theory, they could demand arbitration even though they didn't have a security or customer agreement in place with that broker, because that broker was a broker that for whom Bear Stearns acted as a clearing agent. And defendants do not cite any case in which the arbitration was compelled in a customer agreement as here, where the customer or the controversy did not involve the account maintained by the clearing broker or transaction where the signatory clearing broker was not a party or in any way connected. In fact, even their authority that they cite for the first time in their reply brief, Hamel v. Stratton Oakmont, which is a 1992 case, but they claim it's squarely on point, I would submit they should have cited that in their main brief so we could respond to it. But in that case, a careful reading of that case indicates that the introducing broker, Stratton Oakmont, signed the customer agreement with the investor which provided for the arbitration. So therefore, any private placements that Stratton Oakmont made with the investor would be subject to arbitration. This is different, this is sort of like a reverse of our case, because under the Stratton Oakmont agreement, Stratton Oakmont said, this shall apply also to our clearing broker. So it's kind of a reverse of the agreement that we have here, and that's borne out in Sanders versus Gardner, 7F sub 2nd at 154 note 2, which sets out, which cites the case, the Hamel case, and also sets out the terms, the actual terms of the Stratton Oakmont agreement. The purpose of the Federal Arbitration Act is to promote arbitration as a means of dispute resolution. Accepting defendant's argument and allowing broad and overly expansive reading of the arbitration provision will be counterproductive to that purpose, because contract parties will back away from arbitration provisions if they believe that the courts will compel them to arbitrate disputes they had not intended or agreed upon. The district court was correct in finding and holding that the parties to the agreement did not intend to arbitrate the dispute involved herein, and it should be affirmed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kim. Mr. Gallinari, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
In paragraph 24 of the arbitration clause, it says that the controversies to be arbitrated include those whether arising prior to or subsequent to the opening and maintaining of this particular account. So the text of the arbitration agreement itself contemplates drawing in disputes other than those involving the opening and maintaining of this account. In response to Judge Easterbrook's question earlier about New York law, I believe the Blimpy case we cited to in our brief refers back to the standard that I had mentioned to Your Honors previously regarding the prevailing legal standard regarding the construction of the arbitration clause and its scope. A claim regarding how cash balances were handled by the introducing broker in the account would relate to the account, but not necessarily to any act or omission by Bear Stearns. Is that a claim that would or would not be covered within the scope? Clearly, it would be within the reasonable expectations of the parties that activities by BLC with respect to the accounts would be covered by the arbitration clause, but they would, again, have nothing to do with Bear Stearns, so the involvement of Bear Stearns can't be the determinative factor.
Okay.
I see my time has expired.
Thank you to both counsel. Last case.